Join Sam and Will as they bring the Bible's stories to life through historical evidence and try not to feel out of place in a car garage, all while bringing you Under the Hood.
Welcome to Under the Hood. I'm your host, Will Bushman. I'm here alongside Sam Kastensmith. Sam, what are we talking about today?
Today we're going to be talking about one of the most famous stories in all the Bible, something that almost everybody's familiar with, David and Goliath.
Great.
A great story of a young shepherd boy who goes out to fight against a massive giant Philistine.
And I know everyone's heard this story, but kind of the wild part before we get to the crazy stuff in the story is the real background of how all of this unfolds.
Yeah, so actually the Philistines are, they've been a kind of a mysterious group of people for a long time, and it's only just recently that we know who they are. They kind of just all of a sudden appear on the coast of the Mediterranean sometime around 1200, and they actually drive away some of the Israelites who used to be coastal peoples from the tribe of Dan, one of the 12 tribes. They relocate. When the Philistines come, they're like, we're out. These guys are way, way too advanced. So they go way north, and the Philistines live in the coastal towns on the Mediterranean, about 1200. So if you're in the Bible, that's going to be during the time and the period of the Judges. And so sometime around 1200 BC, they show up, and you find story after story after story where the Israelites are having to contend with the Philistines. So Samson, which is one of the figures at the end of the book of Judges, is constantly getting into it with the Philistines. When Samuel comes along, or the first king that comes along, King Saul, they're constantly having to deal with the Philistines. And one of the things that made the Philistines a real threat, because this is happening right at the beginning, the turn from the Bronze Age to the Iron Age, is they had iron weapons and the Israelites did not.
So that's a huge advantage, obviously. So they're militaristic, they're kind of a serious people that you don't want to fight.
That's correct. And the Bible talks about this in 1 Samuel 13. It says, now there was no blacksmith to be found throughout all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, let the Hebrews make themselves swords or spears. But every one of the Israelites went down to the Philistines to sharpen their plowshares, their mattock, their axe, or their sickle. And so what that's saying is the Philistines actually had control over the Israelites, and they were saying, you're not allowed to have technology for your weapons that would make them iron, which shows you who's running the show.
Yeah, that's not where you want to be as the people of Israel.
No.
You can't win a battle if they have superior technology.
That's correct. And the Philistines kept them from having iron weapons. And one of the cool things that they have discovered from all of the strata, when they dig down and they're looking at the civilization during this particular time period, when you go to the Philistine towns, just like the Bible claims, you find iron weapons during this time. And in all of the Israelite towns, they're still using bronze daggers and knives and spearheads. And so it's exactly as the Bible says. That's what you find in the archaeological record too. So the Philistines, they're militarily far more advanced than the Israelites of this time.
And so that's important background to know now as we enter into the story of the fight between David and Goliath.
Yeah, that's right. And so when you're in the Bible, you go to 1 Samuel chapter 17, and that's where you find the story of David and Goliath. The way that this unfolds, like, it starts telling you some of the geography of what's going on, and the geography is important. So in verse 1, it says, now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle. They gathered at Soko, which belongs to Judah. So that's the Israelites. So they're in their turf. They're encamped there between Soko and Azekah. And then it says, at Ephes Damim. And what, we don't know Hebrew. So that's like, what is it? The word Ephes Damim literally means the border of blood. And so you've got to imagine, here's the Philistine territory. Here's the Israelite territory. The Valley of Elah, where this is going to take place, is right on the border. And the reason why it's called the border of blood is this is where all their skirmishes for territory and land have traditionally happened. And the name Soko literally means it's like a wall. It's like taking branches and everything else that forms a fence. That's the idea of Soko, and the reason why it was named that is it was a fence that kept them out. And so now you have the Philistines that are right on the border. This particular land is a valley that comes between the mountain range that gives them full access to the land of Israel. And so if Israel loses this, they lose a key strategic military point in Israel.
Yeah, we kind of miss out on that as we read the story of David and Goliath sometimes. We see that it's, oh, just these fight between these two guys, but there's real huge dramatic consequences as two armies are staring each other down. And I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't really want to enter into the border of blood. So I'm sure they're wondering, okay, what's going to happen in this moment?
Yeah, and so what you find in the story is there's this guy named Goliath that we're going to meet in a moment. And he's this massive guy, and he comes out, and he's taunting the armies of Israel. And it goes on for 40 days where you have the Israelites on one mountain range, and across the valley on another mountain range, you have the Philistines. And he's coming out, and he's mocking God, and he's mocking the Israelites, and he's challenging them, you send out a champion to fight me. And if you find anybody in your army who can defeat me, then all of our people will be your slaves. But if you defeat me, then all of our people will be your slaves. And this is what's called a champion battle. And you find that in the ancient world. So one of the more famous ones is the battle between Achilles and Hector. If you know the story of Greek history, where you have these two guys that go out and they battle one another. And whoever wins, that army wins. And it was kind of like the lead dog on each side fights and it spares the armies. And so Goliath is saying, let's have a champion battle. I'll represent all my people. You give me one to represent all your people, and whoever wins, wins. And so big stakes, but for 40 days, the Israelites are so afraid, not only of the Philistines who have, you know, strategic advantage, but they're afraid of this massive giant of a man. And so David will come onto the scene, we'll see in a little bit. His father sends him with supplies for war to bring to his brothers. You bring some bread, some wine, don't miss that, because that's the emblems of communion. And he comes onto the stage and hears Goliath, and he's not having it.
Right, so you've mentioned Goliath, and you've mentioned the fact that every part of the Israelite army is terrified of this guy. So why are they so scared of him?
Well, they're scared of him, one, because he's coming with all the Philistine equipment, but even more than that, this guy's massive. And, you know, you'll see some cartoons where, you know, they depict Goliath like he's 50 foot or something crazy
Godzilla
like that.
Style.
Yeah, no, it's not that extreme. So, but if you look at 1 Samuel 17, verse 4, it says, there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion. There it is. This is a champion battle. A champion named Goliath of Gath. Gath is his hometown. And it says whose height was 6 cubits and a span. Well, a cubit in the ancient world was a form of measurement, and it went from your elbow to your fingertip. So traditionally, that's about 18 inches. And a span is the distance of your hand. And so if you do, okay, 18 inches times 6 cubits, that's 1.5 feet. Times 6, that's 9 feet plus another 6 inches. So this guy is 9'6". And so when you're looking at him, he is towering over everyone else. And so he's a massive person. In our modern times, for just context, the Guinness Book of World Records says that the tallest man that's been measured in modernity goes back to the 1940s, was a guy named Robert Wadlow. And he measured 8'11", so 7 inches short of where Goliath would have been. But it, like I said, it's not beyond the realm of possibilities that you could have a guy this massive. It's close to the tallest that we see here today in modernity.
And Goliath isn't the first, let's say, giant that we've seen in the scriptures, right?
Correct. So if you go back to the days of Moses, when Moses is leading the people out of Egypt, he goes through the wilderness, and then he's telling the people, like, you're going to go and you're going to take the promised land. And there's a famous story where he sends the 12 spies in, and 10 of them come back, and they're terrified because they say the people that are in this land make us look like grasshoppers in their sight. Like, they're just absolutely massive. And Moses himself in Deuteronomy chapter 9 is telling them that they're going to have to go in and fight. And listen to how he describes them. Against a people great and tall, the sons of the Anakim, whom you know and of whom you have heard it said, who can stand before the sons of Anak? And so there's this people group called the Anakim that through the Old Testament is associated with being massive.
Okay.
And Goliath is one of them, one of the very few of them that's left.
So as we talk about these giants in the Bible, part of what we love about this show is taking something that maybe when we read it in the scriptures sounds crazy, it sounds outlandish, but a lot of times we find it rooted in history and archaeology. Is there any part where these guys play a role in that?
Yeah, there's actually a guy whose name is Alan Johnson, and he's comes out of Wheaton College. And when he was looking, he's saying, like, is there anything to the Anakim? Like, did they exist? And one of the things that he found is when he went to Egypt, there was something called execration texts. And what in Egypt, what they would do if they had an enemy that they absolutely hated is they would make, like, pottery, and they would write their name or capture their image on the pottery, and then they would go out, they would put a curse on these people, and then they would smash the jar, as in, like, I'm smashing you, and that's going to be your fate. And so they have found execration, a jar with the Anakim name on it. Huh. So Egypt looked at the Anakim, ancient Egypt, before David, and they had problems with this people group called the Anakim. So that's interesting. Another thing that's fascinating is there's a professor that came out of Bar-Ilan University, and his name's Aaron Mayer. And he found when they were excavating the Philistine city of Gath, you remember what's significant about Gath?
Goliath.
That's where Goliath comes from. And it just so happens that they found pottery that dates back to the 10th century BC, which is right in the time frame. And on this pottery, it has the name Goliath.
Wow.
And now they didn't use vowels back then. And so a lot of people are like, well, it might not be Goliath, but everybody says it's remarkably similar. Like, it's for sure telling us that that's a common name among the Philistines. If it wasn't the Goliath, it's certainly a Goliath. And so that adds some credibility to the story. And I think perhaps my favorite one is when you go into Egypt, because remember, Egypt is, you know, they've got the execration text with the Anakim mentioned on it. But they actually, before David, about 250 years before David is born, they have a battle of Kadesh, and this is where the Egyptians are fighting the Hittites. And if you know geography, for the Egyptians to get up to the Hittites to fight the Battle of Kadesh, they have to go through the coastal territory of the Philistines with their armies to get there. And so they run across these people that they call the Shashsu, which means wanderers. So they don't name their nationality or whatever, but they're saying in this particular territory, there's these people called the Shashsu, and you can see in this image that you have Egyptians that are next to these kneeling Shashsu, and these people are gargantuan. Yeah. Kneeling, they're every bit as tall as the Egyptians are, which is crazy because in Egyptian artwork, you always find the Egyptians larger than their enemies. The Pharaoh is almost like a giant always, and they're just tiny in his sight. So you never saw the Egyptians portraying their enemies as being larger than them. And yet in this particular artwork with the Shashsu that are coming from the Philistine territories, these guys are massive. And also with this, you find something called the Anastasi Papyrus that comes from Egypt during this time, and it's with people that were happening during the Battle of Kadesh. And so they would send scribes with their military, right, to go keep track of what's happening in the battle, to give a report back to Pharaoh, to keep a historical record. And two of the scribes are Hori and a guy named Amenemope. And Hori is absolutely crushing, you know, Amenemope, making fun of him for being a coward. But I want you to listen to why Hori is saying that Amenemope is a coward. Listen to the record. He says, the narrow defile, so the little piece of land between the Mediterranean and the mountain ranges where the Philistines are, the narrow defile is infested with Shashsu, concealed beneath the bushes. Some of them are 4 cubits or of 5 cubits. Now, an Egyptian cubit is 20 inches, a little bit bigger than a Hebrew cubit. From nose to foot, so it's not even the full measurement. I'm not even sure what that means, from nose to foot. He says, they're fierce of face. Their heart is not mild. They hearken not to coaxing. You can't talk sense to these people. They're angry. They're aggressive. They're warlike, and they measure 5 cubits. Now, that's 8.5 feet, so which is actually, when you look at the artwork that we see with those Shashsu, that's to scale. They would have been about 8.5 feet standing up. And so when you look at this, you've got the Egyptian that are mentioning the Anakim. You have the Egyptians that are mentioning giants in the land of Philistia before David ever comes along. And so, yeah, I think a reasonable person can say, why is there so much consensus
that we have really large people dwelling in this land, coming from Samuel, coming from Moses, coming from Hori, coming from the artwork and the Egyptian tombs. There were large people in this land.
Yeah, the record starts to add up that, yeah, we can't point to directly to Goliath. You know, we don't have his bones. We don't have everything. We don't have a picture of him.
We got a jar with his name on it.
Yeah, we see these kinds of things, though. They're like, as the people would have been reading the story or hearing about the story, that there was this giant that was facing off against the people of Israel. They weren't going to be shocked by that.
No. One of the other things that they found when they were excavating the different Philistine cities is when you get to Gath, everything is noticeably larger. That's just weird to me. You know, like all of the stones become larger. The walkways become larger and taller. The weight of the stones becomes 2 to 3 to 4 times more in the city of Gath, which is where Goliath comes from. Now, that could totally be coincidental, but it's just interesting.
Yeah, if you had a bunch of giants walking around, they're probably like, let's make this place a little more comfortable for the people like us.
Yeah, it's going to be bigger.
Okay, so we know Goliath was tall. What else about him would have been feared?
The way that he looked, like when he comes out to battle, this guy is decked out head to toe in armor that would have been very impressive. So I want to read to you the way that it describes him, and you'll notice some things that the Bible wants you to take in because it repeats it a lot. It says he had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a coat of scale armor of bronze weighing 5,000 shekels. That sounds like a lot. It's about 125 pounds. It's a lot of armor. And by the way, the armor of King Henry VIII was 94 pounds. So
okay.
There's a lot of armor. On his legs, he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. What word do you hear?
Bronze.
Bronze. Bronze. Bronze. And there's a reason why, and we're going to get to it a little bit later, but the reason why it keeps on bronze, 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 the Hebrew word for bronze is nahoshet. It's kind of a fun word to say, but it is very similar to the Hebrew word for serpent, which is nahash. So you hear it? Nahash, nahoshet, nahash, nahoshet. The snake of Palestine, the Palestinian viper, is actually bronze. I mean, it's a bronze snake. And so you think of the bronze serpent on a standard that comes in the book of Numbers in the Bible, like the serpent in Israelite culture was associated with bronze. And so here comes Goliath, and he's got a bronze helmet, which is different than most Philistines of the day. We know what they look like. They had leather and feathered helmets. This is not what this is. He's wearing something that's far more akin to what the Hittites would have wear that would have come to a sharp point. It's a bronze helmet. And then he's got scaled armor, and it's nahoshet. Let's hear the snake. He's got the greaves on his feet, everything about him. And then listen to this. There's a spear shaft that's like a weaver's rod, and it's slung. He's got a javelin that's slung down the middle of his back. Well, if you're scaled and you're bronze and every part of you is covered in this bronze and you have a javelin that's slung between your shoulders, what does it look like? It looks like a tail that's coming off. You've got a pointed head. Everything about him looks like a
snake.
Snake. Well, that's no small thing when you're talking in terms of the Bible, because who is the snake in the Bible? It's always the enemy. From the beginning of Genesis 3, that is the enemy that brought death into the world. In the story of Moses, it represents Pharaoh's crown. And now you have David, who's going to be squaring off against this gargantuan, super powerful warrior who's coming to represent all the enemies of the people of God. And he looks like a snake. Like, this is not accidental. Like, in God's sovereignty, he is delivering to us a message that we shouldn't miss here. And it says his shield bearer went ahead of him. So it's not enough that he's 9'6". It's not enough that he's covered in head from head to toe in 125 pounds of armor. He's got a shield bearer. It's like his own little caddy, you know, that's leading out into war. And he's like, who wants some of this? And all of Israel for 40 days is going, not me. And then David, this shepherd boy, you had to be 20 years old to fight in the Israelite army. David's younger than that, as are a number of his brothers who are not on the battlefront was. So it's telling you, David's not just close to 20. He's got older brothers that aren't yet 20, and he's at the tail end of eight sons. So he's 13, 14 years old. He's a young shepherd boy, and yet he's the one who's going to stand to fight as the champion of Israel against the champion of the Philistines. And it is a total mismatch.
Okay, so how does David get there into this battle?
So his dad, Jesse, sends him to the battle to take supplies for the sons. And he comes on a donkey, bearing bread and wine, the emblems of communion, and he shows up and he sees all of this going on. And here's Goliath on day 40. Like, all right, who's going to come fight me? And David's looking around like, do none of you trust the Lord? Like, why is nobody standing up to this guy? He's blaspheming the name of the Lord. Like, somebody do something. And then, you know, he hears that the king is offering huge rewards to anybody that will go out and fight Goliath. So it says the king would give him great wealth to the man who kills him. He will give him his daughter in marriage, and he will exempt his family from taxes. And so everybody related to him no longer has to pay. He gets a bride out of the deal and just a tremendous inheritance of wealth. And so eventually David's like, I'll fight him, which, you know, everybody's looking at, you're not even 20 years old. You're a young kid. But eventually they bring him in front of the king, and the king's like, well, you know, you're kind of young. And he makes the case like, let me go fight him. Like, I have fought against the bear. I fought against the lion, and God has delivered me out of the hands of both of them. My God has been faithful to me against predators all my life. Let me go fight him. And eventually Saul's like, well, I got no one else who's stepping up to the plate. So I'm going to let you go. And oh, by the way, here's my armor. And so you have Saul, who tries to give David all of his armor, you know, helmet and shield and breastplate and everything else. And David does something that reveals the depth of his faith. Because I've always heard it in Sunday school, like it was way too big for him, and he was swimming in it and it didn't fit. But what he actually says is, these have not proven themselves. God has. God has delivered me from the bear, and God has delivered me from the lion. I don't need your armor. I'm going to trust in the Lord to be my shield. And that's kind of, I mean, we hear that and we're like, dude, take the
put
armor.
Put something on.
Yeah. But he is so filled with faith that that is going to be the chief weapon that David has. It's not all the armor. It's not the weapons. I mean, if we're talking about Bronze Age and Iron Age and all that stuff, David goes with stone. He's in the Stone Age. Like, you know, and he takes no advantage except the faith that he believes God will defend him and vindicate him, which is stunning. And so the battle comes forward.
Yeah, it's really amazing, because his whole theme throughout that is not trust in weapons or trust in armor, but I'm going to trust in the Lord. And this boy is a little bit crazy, because he does just walk out there in just his normal wear, and he picks up a couple of rocks and a slingshot, and that's what he takes into this battle.
Yeah, that's right. Both you and I have been to Israel, and we've gone to the Valley of Elah where this battle happens, and you see the dried up riverbed where he would have come down from the mountain, and it's just filled with stones that are, you can tell the water has taken away all the rough edges, and they're incredibly smooth. You can go there to this day and pick them up and take them home. And
unless you're not supposed to.
We have.
The government of Israel. I should not have those in my possession. I apologize.
Oh, is that illegal?
I don't know, but I'm just making sure if they ever see this.
We never did that.
I do not have any.
But anyway, like, they're absolutely smooth. And so he goes with nothing but a sling and five stones and the clothes on his back that he came with. And he's going to confront Goliath. Now, to be fair, in the ancient, a sling in the hands of somebody who's capable is outrageously effective. Like, they were insanely accurate at the time. They actually did a study in Germany that found in the hands of somebody who's adequately trained, a sling and a stone has almost the same stopping power as a Magnum 44.
Wow.
Tremendously powerful in the hands of the right person. And so David is going out there with this sling, and he's looking at somebody who's covered head to toe in armor. So as we're coming toward the end of this story, we get to the climax, and this should be a big clue as to what this whole story is pointing us at, because it's not a story about, you know, if you just believe the little guy can take down the big guy, like, that's a wonderful part of the story. and God does avenge the underdogs very, very often. But listen to the way the story plays out and see if you can hear something in the story. So you have a shepherd boy from Bethlehem who's coming out, and he's going up against this massive enemy who's representing all the enemies of God's people. And this guy is dressed head to toe, and he looks, you know, scaled armor and everything else, and he looks like a snake, and he's blaspheming God. And listen to how the story ends. It says, the Philistine moved closer to attack him. David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him, reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down on the ground. Now, if you are following from the beginning of Scripture, when we talked about the significance of the serpent from the beginning, the first time the promise of the gospel is given, it says that the seed of the woman is going to have animosity against the seed of the serpent, but that one day the seed of the woman would crush the head of the snake. How is Goliath defeated? His head is crushed. What does he look like? A snake. And it's the champion of God's people who represent all of God's people who runs out and defeats the snake to give them victory. And what does he win? He wins a bride. That's the story of Christ. When he defeats the snake, he wins a bride. And now all of his family is no longer subject to pay anymore. And he receives a great inheritance. And he is the champion who's won on behalf of everyone else who didn't lift a finger to achieve this victory. That's the gospel. That's what Jesus has done for us. He is the champion. He's the great shepherd who stood up in front to go and do battle against the serpent, except he took a mortal wound and destroyed the serpent and defeated sin and death forever and allows us to share in the great inheritance. And that's what the story of David and Goliath is pointing to. The fact that God raises up a champion filled with faith to defeat the serpentine warrior so that all of his people can have victory. Now that's something we can sing about, because it's not just their story. That's our story. That's our hero. And that's wonderful.
That is amazing.
But the story's still not over, right?
That's right. So after the rock goes in and crushes his head. This they leave this out of a lot of the children's tales,
this
right?
This is not it.
It says that David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone without a sword in his hand. He struck down the Philistine and killed him. And then listen to what David does. He ran and stood over him, took hold of the Philistine's sword and drew it from its sheath. And after he killed him, he cut off his head with the sword. And when the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they turned and ran. And it says that they ran and they went to the town of Sha'arim, that literally means in Hebrew, two gates. And right at the Valley of Elah, there's a town called Sha'arim. And guess how many gates it has? Two. Not surprising. And then we're told that he takes that head, and you got to think, why in the world does he do this? Like, and what is he doing with this? It says that he takes the head and goes to the city of Jerusalem, which is not yet the capital of Israel, and he buries it there. Now, that's just fascinating. And you read the story and it's over and you think, okay, this is done. That was kind of weird. Why not bury it, you know, in the Valley of Elah? Like, what's so special? Why does he take this skull and take it to Jerusalem? But you fast forward 1,000 years and the one to whom this whole story is pointing, the one who trusts truly will crush the head of the snake, goes to a cross, and where is he crucified? He's crucified on top of a mountain that is called Golgotha. And what does that mean? The place of the skull. And what do you hear in that? Goliath from Goth, Golgotha, which is how the etymology of that word probably came about, the place of the skull. So Goliath's head is buried in Jerusalem, and then Jesus is going to be crucified at a place called the place of the skull. And it's inviting you to recognize or to dream or to think, maybe Jesus is accomplishing the ultimate redemption for the people of God in the very same place where David buried the skull of the serpentine warrior. And it's just the poetic nature of God. It's really beautiful that that's where, not with a sling and a stone, but two outstretched arms on a cross, taking your sin, my sin, the shame of all the world, not with any great triumph, but enduring all the shame and guilt and everything else that we deserved, taking the wrath that we deserved so that we can have all of the inheritance and the privilege that he deserved. That's our God. That's how good he is. And that's what the story of David and Goliath is pointing to.
It's amazing that Jesus is our champion.
He is our champion. And we have victory because of him and him alone.
Amen.
Thank you for watching. Join us next time as we go under the hood of another story in the Bible.